Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is John Naisbitt, who reads from and discusses his new book, Mindset, Reset Your Thinking and See the Future, published by HarperCollins. In the weeks to come, we have Jeff Shara, Les Claypool, Nick Bantock, Jerry Spence, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. With megatrends, John Naisbitt changed the way we saw the world, and the book became one of publishing's greatest success stories. Megatrends was at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for more than 2 years, was published in 57 countries, and sold more than 8 million copies. Always looking forward, John Naisbitt now brings us Mindset, a powerful new book that encourages readers to transform their attitudes towards the future by putting the focus on our minds and how we receive and cultivate information. John Naisbitt has become the global philosopher among futurists. His experience reaches from executive positions in the corporate world to appointments by President Kennedy and President Johnson. John is former visiting professor at Harvard University. He is the recipient of 15 honorary doctorates in the humanities, technology, and science, and is the Distinguished International Fellow, Institute of Strategic International Studies in Malaysia. Currently, he is faculty member at the Nanjing University in China. We are honored to have John Naisbitt with us tonight at the Tattered Cover to present his stunning new book, Mindset. Please welcome John Naisbitt.
Thank you very much, Christine, and good evening. I'm very happy to be here. I feel right at home here. I was a resident of Telluride, Colorado, for 18 years. And during that period of time, I was in Denver quite a bit at the Tattered Cover, which became my favorite bookstore in the whole world. So I'm really pleased and honored to be here this evening. I also have one of those honorary doctorates is from the University of Denver. I was born and raised next door. In southern Utah, I grew up on a sugar beet farm in southern Utah until I managed to get out of Utah. I dropped out of high school when I was 15 and was working as digging ditches for the Utah Power and Light Company, and that didn't seem to be very exciting. But when I was 17, I learned that I could join the Marine Corps, and that would get me out of Utah. We're talking desperation here. And as it turned out, that was a bit of desperation. So I'm really very devoted to this part of the world. And as I say, I feel very comfortable being back here in the old neighborhood. I will talk a little bit, not for too long, though, maybe 15 minutes about my new book and what's in it, and then I would like to respond to your questions or challenges or whatever. The book is about the future, and it's sort of like Megatrends in that I talk about five pictures that I have of the future, not the whole world, but huge parts of the world that I'm quite interested in. But I do that with the mindsets that I developed. This is a kind of market-driven book. There were so many people over the years who not only said, what's the next megatrend, but who said, well, how do you know? Essentially, what they said was, how do you do what you do? So the more I thought about that, the more I really examined how I do what I do, and finally figured it out, and now I'm sharing that with those who are interested, and it's really fairly straightforward. For example, one of the mindsets is focus on the score of the game, and I draw here from sports. I don't know how you read newspapers, but I always read newspapers back to front. because the sports are almost always in the back, and that's not only in American newspapers and newspapers all over the world. And I love sports, but not only that, sports reporting is the best and most reliable reporting there is. So that when I read, as I did a couple of months ago, that Italy beat France 5-3 in the World Cup, I have virtually 100% confidence that that actually occurred. So that's my model. And so as I read from the back of the paper up toward the front of the paper, I get, you know, a decreasing confidence in the reporting, and by the time I get to the first page, it's front page is down quite a bit. But my model remains the sports model, the score of the game. Does the information I have about the global economy, about politics around the world, about anything, does it have the credibility, and do I have the confidence in it that I have in the reporting that I get on the sports pages? Another thing that I like to think about in connection with the thinking about the world is my admonition and my mindset that don't get so far ahead of the parade that people don't know you're in it. That's a very good thing for leadership. You know, lots of people get too far ahead of the parade, and maybe that's what happened in connection with last Tuesday. I don't know. Maybe Bush was so far ahead of the parade, or he was leading a different parade. I don't know, but it's something like that, you know, because when you're trying to lead a parade, you really want to stay just a couple steps ahead. People are not interested. In my line of work, when people say, well, this is what is going to happen in 2040, 2050, it's impossible to know, so I don't know how they do that. But in any case, no one cares. It's just too far out there, too far away. What people care about is what's going to happen right out in front of them in relation to what they already know. So don't get so far ahead of the parade. They don't know you're in it. So as I look at the world and look at the alleged leaders in the world and so forth, I try to figure out how, to what extent they're within the field of vision of the people that they are intending to lead. And as I will say about Europe, none of them are within the field of vision of the people they want to lead. And all entrepreneurs know this, but another measure I have of people who really get things done and move the world is the mindset that says you don't get results by solving problems, but by exploiting opportunities. You get results by doing something creative with opportunities, with openings. And the world is sort of divided in some ways between opportunity seekers and problem solvers. I'll give you some examples from U.S. politics, as long as we're here. I live in Europe, and I fancy I have a little clearer view at the distance. I live in Vienna. As I look at the political scene, for example, Hillary Clinton is a great problem solver. She wants to solve problems. And remember when she and Bill Clinton moved in the White House, they just barely got there when she jumped in and wanted to solve the health care problem. On the other hand, Arnold Schwarzenegger, an Austrian, is a great opportunity seeker. He's lived in California for a long time, and for a long time he wanted to be governor of California. The problem solver would say, okay, we've got the Republican primaries coming up in 3 years or 2 years, and so we've got to win that. And so they make all these elaborate plans on how to solve this problem, getting on the ballot so that he'd be governor. And then in California, this bizarre thing happened with Gray Davis being recalled as governor. And on the day people in California went to the polls, they had two questions to answer. One, should Gray Davis be recalled as governor? And two, should he be recalled, who would you like to see as governor? And on that second question, there were 138 names. Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of them. He got more votes than anyone, but he didn't even get 50% of the votes. But because he got more votes, he became governor. And I remember during the campaign, almost everywhere he went, he pledged that if he was elected governor, he wouldn't make any more movies. And I think that's really what put him over the top. It was an irresistible appeal. let me interrupt myself by, as I think about another irresistible appeal. My wife, Doris, is here on the front row, and she was my publisher. My German language publisher, and that's how we met. You know, I was the author and she was the publisher. She was really the best publisher I've ever had, and it got my attention. And 7 years ago, we were married, and in Dürnstein, which is a wonderful old 1,300-year-old village on the banks of the Danube, and we were married in a place where they've been marrying people for 700 years, and it's great. And now she has since left the house. She was the head of a publishing house in Austria, the only woman head of a publishing house in Austria. And so after we got married, we decided we wanted to travel. We were traveling so much, but she couldn't both head the house and travel all this, so she left that. And because we didn't have a proper job by then, we decided to base in Vienna, which turns out to be a great place to base. It's a wonderful, wonderful city, and it's very close to Asia. We can get on a plane and fly nonstop to Shanghai in 8.5 hours. We flew here to Denver from Frankfurt. It took more than 10 hours. So in general, Asia and the United States are about the same distance from Vienna, and Vienna, Austria is bordered by 7 different countries, and it's right in the heart of Europe, so it's a great place to base and to operate out of. I want to mention some of the pictures for the future, but let me first mention one other mindset. It's probably the most important, for me, the most important mindset I have, and that is understanding how powerful it is not to have to be right. Having to be right really runs people. You see this in personal relationships. You see partners who are quarreling about who's right and who's wrong. And, you know, after a while, the consideration that started the argument is forgotten, and what's really important is who's right and who's wrong. And having to be right runs you, that closes everything off. That closes off learning, it closes off growing. And the political parties have institutionalized having to be right. The political parties have to be right. The other party is wrong no matter what they do, and we're right no matter what we do, and they're run by having to be right. And that's why I think we have such, as I view it from Europe anyway, such a sort of toxic atmosphere among the political parties in this country. I guess for me, the most interesting picture of the future, I have 11 of those mindsets, and that's 4 of them. The most interesting picture of the future that I talk about in the book is that we're shifting from a world that's organized with a collection of nation states to what I call economic domains. The globalization that's taking place in the world is the globalization of economic activities. And it's moving at a great rate. And it's a conceptual fallacy to think that countries create their economies and that they're self-contained economies, and then you add them all up and that's the world economy. There's no such thing as a German economy anymore. There's no such thing as a U.S. economy. We're so intertwined and interlaced with each other, you can't sort out what's German and what's not German, what's American and what's not American. So the only way we can truly understand what's going on in the world is to look economically, is to look at the economic domains, the automobile domain, the steel domain, the pharmaceutical domain, the tourist domain, and so forth, which are fairly transparent. They're much more transparent than countries are. So we could have that, I guess, as an additional index to the gross domestic product index that we have today. And people talk about a borderless world, and it's really not true of countries. The country's borders, paradoxically, are getting more important. What doesn't have borders is economic activities. The automobile domain has no borders whatsoever. The financial services domain has no borders. That's where we are getting a borderless world. And the more we're getting borders more around our country, because the more we become economically dependent on others, and the more we get economically interrelated with others, the more we consciously or unconsciously become concerned about our cultural identity. The more we celebrate our cultural identity, and there's sort of a cultural nationalism in our borders, then so the French become, God help us, more French, and the Chinese more Chinese, and all the rest of it. But these things are going on simultaneously, and one reinforces the other. We are at once becoming more economically interdependent and celebrating our cultural diversity, one country from another. And one of those parts of the world is Europe. I would say, and I do say in the book, that the statue of Europe has two hearts and 25 mindsets. The EU has 25 mindsets, and is about to have two more in January, 27 mindsets. The two hearts, and no leadership. No leadership in Europe. For a while, I was very hopeful about Tony Blair, but then he became so wounded by Iraq that really declined pretty rapidly. But the two hearts that are beating asymmetrically are the heart that beats for the social model, for the social welfare model, which the Europeans are holding on to at all costs. That's one heart. The other heart is the heart of economic supremacy, and I do mean supremacy. That's the dream. The famous meeting in Lisbon, Portugal, in 2000, when all the heads of state in the EU, 15 at the time, said, we are going to create, by the year 2010, the most dynamic, knowledge-based economic region in the world. And they've renewed that pledge every spring, even to this day. And it's obviously a challenge to the United States. But every year since 2000, the EU has lost ground economically against the United States. So they give lip service to this and to economic reform, but there's no economic reform. And as long as this continues to be the case, and I don't see it changing, then I think Europe will continue on the path, as I say in the book, on the path to a mutually assured decline. Harsh words, maybe. But I say that in Europe as well as here. And sometimes people think I'm sort of pro-American or something, and I say, I'm not talking about America. I'm talking about Europe, and I want you to notice that I live in Europe. I love living in Europe. I love the lifestyle. But that doesn't mean that I shade my eyes from the lack of economic reforms that are necessary to meet their goals and necessary to sustain Europe. Europe has a birth rate of 1.3. You need 2.1 birth rate to sustain your population. And they won't take in any immigrants to make up for the shortfall. If these two things continue in just two generations, Europe will have one half the population it has today. Now, that's okay if that's what Europe wants, but that's not what it says it wants, not what the so-called leaders say they want. They say they want to be this great, dynamic economic engine. So that's a problem. I will end with China. Lots of people say that they are concerned, anyway, about China breaking up. Well, China is breaking up. China is decentralizing more than any other other country in the world by far. And it's only this decentralization that will maintain and sustain a really powerful economy, just as globalization. The twin path the world is traveling on is globalization and decentralization. And decentralization is necessary to sustain the globalization that's occurring. The subtitle of my chapter on China is "The Periphery is the Center." And that's an old Chinese saying during the time of all the empires. The periphery is the center, meaning that what is going on around China in the various provinces, that's the center. That's what really is the essence of China. And that's what's happening today. It's not Beijing, it's in the provinces. And the province, you know, in China today, the Beijing pretends to rule and the provinces pretend to be ruled. But they are initiating all of these economic reforms. They are building cities, new cities. They are adding to their cities. They're building airports all over the place, international airports, so you can fly right into my province. The direct foreign investment is going directly into the provinces. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have this hype in the media that China, this great economic engine, is going to overtake the United States next Tuesday morning. It'll be 35 or 40 years before that happens, if it ever happens. China just barely bumping up against, has not yet achieved, going back to the old measure of gross domestic product, has not yet achieved true $2 trillion. It's less than $2 trillion. The United States is an economy of almost $13 trillion. Growing at a half a trillion a year, and it's not going to stop growing. Even if China continues at 10%, and that's unlikely, but it's, let's say they do, it'll be 35 years before they catch up, quotes, or even suggest that they overtake the United States. So I think we have to keep, that's the score of the game. I think we have to keep those things in perspective. But, you know, China is such an this is not to deny that China is such an interesting place and that all this growth is taking place and hundreds of millions of people have come out of poverty in the last three decades. Doris and I go to China. We're going there now. We'll be there at the end of the month. We go there two or three times a year, and it's just a very exciting place to go. Shanghai, if you haven't been there, Shanghai is the most exciting, dazzling city on the planet. And It's really wonderful what's going on in China. The art world, we're very interested in art. We've been collecting art for many years. And in the West, not much is going on in contemporary art. But in China and in Asia, as a function of all of the change that's going on and the yeastiness of those changes in the culture and the artists who express and manifest these kind of changes, the art scene in the West, especially in China, is very, very exciting. And a little while ago, we started to collect contemporary Chinese art, which is very, very interesting. So mindsets, pictures of the future, that's a little gallop through a sense of what the book is about. But I would welcome your questions or your challenges or your stories about the world for the rest of the period that we have today. Yes.
Thank you for coming from Vienna to spend an evening with us. That will take place to deal with it.
Perhaps I'm not the person to ask. I say this to my European colleagues and friends. I'm a first-generation American. My mother was born in Denmark. My father was born in Scotland. And I think that I'm one of those many who celebrates immigration. It's not by chance that the United States, certainly economically, but I think in other ways, but certainly economically, is the most successful country in the world. It's not by chance that it's made up of all the peoples of the world. And I think that Europe at its peril is not admitting immigrants. You know, what the United States is doing is replenishing its talent pool. United States takes in more than 1 million legal and we can talk about Ewing if you like, but I like all immigrants. But the United States is taking in more than 1 million legal immigrants every year, more than all the rest of the world put together, and they've been doing that since 1976. Because who are these people who want to come here, where they have the freedom to work and to do and to make their dreams come true? These are the most talented, entrepreneurial, aggressive, you know, feisty people. I can tell you, the immigrants come to the United States for opportunity. The immigrants come to Europe, where they're trying to get into Europe because of the social model, the social welfare program. This is a very different kind of driven thing. If the United States, because talent is distributed randomly, the United States would have to have an astronomical birth rate, because this is the top of the pyramid that wants to get into the United States in order to have this kind of replenishment of the talent pool. So perhaps you have specific questions about this, but I think that this whole thing about our talent pool being constantly replenished, and that's one of the things that counts so much for the success of the United States. Someone, I was in Japan. One of my visits to Japan, someone from the back of the room said, yeah, but, you know, almost all those Nobel Prize winners come from other countries. And I said, thank you for making my point. Yeah. Mike? Yeah. How I see the role of the city changing. Well, behind that question lies the fact that very soon, half the people in the United States will, half the people in the world will be in cities. And as you ask about the cities, it reminds me back again to China, because the great activity is happening in the cities. You know, in Japan there are 12 cities with 1 million people or more. In the United States there are 9 cities with more than 1 million people. In Great Britain, there's one, just London. How many cities in India, by the way, there are 31 cities that have 1 million or more. How many cities do you think in China have more than 1 million people?
150.
170. These are the closest answers I've ever heard. 166. Can you imagine 166 people? And, you know, there's cities that have 7, 8, 9 million people we've never heard of. And Doris and I have been trying to visit these, and we go to these cities, we've never heard of them. There's 8 million people, you know, and the great energy that's going in there. Anyway, the cities most of the people in the world will be in cities. That creates problems, that creates opportunities. What is your concern about that?
I was wondering how the city, the state that they're in.
Well, I think, you know, that's a very good question, because I think that we're thinking more and more in cities. And by the way, countries don't compete with each other. It's not India versus China. It's Indian companies versus Chinese companies. But with cities, when we fly around the world and we go to Shanghai, we're going to Shanghai. You know, we're not thinking about going to China. We're thinking about going to Shanghai. People fly, they go to San Francisco, they're thinking about San Francisco. And I think I think cities are going to become the stars in the network of activities around the world. Cities will be connected. People will travel to cities more than they travel to the countries. It's what the cities offer, because we're organizing ourselves increasingly as cities. It's almost as if we're going back to the old city-state. And I don't see that slowing down. And I think that the technology really pushes that more than that it detracts from that, the technology that says we can operate anywhere. But I think it's very exciting what's happening in a lot of cities. Yep.
The comment on the issue of our oil dependence.
I won't get in the hairball just now unless you want me to. No, I will do both. Well, first of all, oil dependence. There's this idea abroad in the world that we're running out of oil. We're not running out of oil. We have at least as much oil, half as much oil as we've ever used. And now is just the time, as we only have half left, which may be 50 years or 100 years. Now's the time to really push alternative energy sources, which I don't think we're really serious enough about. And I think we have to do that. And it's really a great time to do it because we have time. We have time. I don't think that oil politically and economically drives things, or that the economics of oil drive things politically as much as a lot of people think. On the Islamic side, and I guess that includes terrorism, almost every religion in the world is growing. And that's because I believe that we're in such a complicated world where there's a lot of change going on in the world. A lot of people are threatened by this and feel unsettled by this. A lot of people want to go to simpler times. People at such times need structure, and they get structure from religion, and they especially get structure from fundamentalism. And whether it's in the Midwest in the United States or in the Middle East, the fundamentalist religions give people the structure that a lot of people need. But the Islamic terrorism question is something that goes beyond that, and I think it's an aberration. As I read history, it's an aberration. It's happened before. It happened during the Christian Crusades and all the rest of it that we know. But it is an aberration. But what's happening is that the West is encouraging that aberration by being run by it. I said, don't be run by having to be right. Well, don't be run by the terrorists either, because in a sense, if you allow the terrorists and the threat of terrorism to run you, you celebrate terrorism. And you celebrate people being terrorists. I mean, it's absolutely crazy to be run by that phenomenon. But in the larger sweep of things, I think it's an aberration, and it won't be with us for too much longer. But the idea of more and more the religions growing, I think, will be with us for a long time, because the world is not going to get simpler. It's going to get more complex. Yep. Well, I don't think any countries will outperform any markets. Countries don't do that. Companies do that. Entrepreneurs do that. You know, and it goes back to what I was saying about, I mean, it's General Motors and General Electric against Siemens and Toyota. That's where the competition is. It's not between countries. The role of countries is to make and to sustain a nourishing environment for people to do what they want to do, including in the field of finance and economics. So the question is not what countries are going to do, but what entrepreneurs are going to do and what companies are going to do in those areas. And I don't know enough about... if I knew which... companies were going to do that best, I would give them a ring. Yes, the climate change? Is it changing? Silence. What do you mean, is it changing? Well, when I was growing up as a little kid in Utah, the big scare was the ice age is going to get you. And I remember as a 7 and 8 year old, I was really was scared that the coming ice age, and it was just like what's going on today. And it was called a global cooling. It would mean a real decline in agriculture, which means a decline in food, and millions upon millions of people would die, and so forth. So. That's in my background, so I'm something of a skeptic. However, I think the remedies are so attractive that I think we ought to work on them. The things about, like the recent report, the Stern Review out of England, talks about what's going to happen 200 years from now, and we got to get busy now, and so on. Seems to me that we ought to get busy now in making sure that everybody in the world has clean water, which costs a fraction of what they're talking about. The remedies are very attractive. Clean air, clean water for everybody. I think we ought to really deal with the things right out in front of us instead of being scared to death by the kind of fear-mongering about what's going to happen 100 years from now if we don't really do something today. And that's something that's going to cost lots of money, and we don't know quite what to do, how to do that. But so, and then I think we ought to, you know, an alternative I talked earlier about, we ought to really get busy on alternative energy sources. Of course, that's part of the picture. And I think, you know, one of the mindsets I have is the things we expect to happen always happen more slowly. And you know, the hybrid fueled car, for 12 years now, I've been waiting for that. Right? And we still haven't got it. We're supposed to get some more models. But those are the things that are right out in front of us that we can relate to. And much of the other stuff is the people who so far ahead of the parade that we don't know they're in it, because what we ought to do is deal with what's right out in front of us. As far as the actual warming, the world has gone up 1 degree in the last 100 years, which is not out of character with the history of the, as we know it, which is rather questionable, for thousands of years. But there's so many things that we ought to attend to, instead of speculating on things we might attend to. Let's get busy on what's right out in front of us. One part of the book that bothered you. Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Well, especially as we sit here in this tabernacle of books this evening. Let me associate myself with, when I write about these things, I'm not making value judgments, but I now will make a value judgment. I want to identify with your question. I fell in love with books. I had never read a book in my life when I went in the Marine Corps, but I discovered you had lots of time in the Marine Corps. But there was a guy, when we were going through boot camp in San Diego, there was a guy, big, strong, strapping guy named, I'll never forget his name, Hunter Shirley. He was from Louisiana. And he was always reading books, you know, in his bunk and so forth. And so I said, Hunter, what are you doing? You know, and he said, this is so interesting. I started to read books, and the first book I ever read in my life, cover to cover, was Irving Stone's book about Van Gogh called Lust for Life. And in some moments, I fancy that that's been my banner. But in any case, what's happening today is that the word is, the importance of the word is receding, and the importance of visuals is ascending. We've talked about the death of the novel for at least 100 years. The novel is not dead; it's losing blood pretty fast. But it depends on what people produce, you know, and the quality of it. What's happened with all these things is that what changes is not, it's not either or. It's, you know, we used to all read and have the word, and now we're going to all do it visually. And it used to be that we had newspapers, and now we're going to all do it digitally. Things don't happen that way. What happens is in the mix, and I think this is clearly happening, in the mix there's more visual than there is the word. Another one of the mindsets is look at the world as a picture puzzle. See the future as a picture puzzle. And so I take the pictures, you take pictures and see if they've isolated things and see if they fit with other pieces, and then eventually forming a picture. And that's why I talk about a visual world, a visual culture is taking over the world. The decline of the newspaper culture. And I don't say the decline of the newspaper, I say the decline of the newspaper culture. You know, how important that's been in our lives and so forth. That's in decline. And it's not that newspapers are going away. It's just in the mix there will be fewer newspapers, and maybe if there are opportunity seekers there, they will make them much better, and we will hold on to them in advertising. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Jeff Shara, Les Claypool, Nick Bantock, Jerry Spence, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 10th, 2006.